because it took 4 days on the river. So we had to camp 2 nights on the river in these large, they call them Arctic oven tents. So very large tents with stoves in them to keep warm. And it was minus 57 degrees Fahrenheit. It was very, very cold, and we were going through overflow.
Hello, I'm Anne Dibben, and this is Unexpected Turns. Today, we hear from Robert Forto, who went from training pampered pooches, and they're even more pampered owners, in the metropolis, to minching in the wilds of Alaska. Let's find out more.
Morning.
Morning, and welcome to Unexpected Turns Pod.
Yes, how are you?
I'm very good. I love the title that comes up there, First Pause Media. I love it.
Oh, yeah, that's the name of our little media company. That's
brilliant. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us all the way over there in Alaska.
Thank you.
It's a bit later in the day here.
Yes.
So I just want... So if you could tell us a little bit about your early life, because you haven't always lived in Alaska. So if you could just take us back a bit and tell us where you came from and how you ended up in Alaska.
Well, let's see. I was born as a military kid, so we traveled around quite a bit as a youngster. We lived all over the lower 48 in the U.S. for many years. I went to high school in Virginia, learned how to drive in the bustling Washington, D.C. traffic. Imagine that as a 16-year-old kid out there with millions of crazy drivers trying to get around in the big city. But I earned my chops there in the East Coast there, and finally went to college in Portland, Oregon in the late 80s, early 90s. And I thought I was going to become a veterinarian. And things took a very quick change, and I think that that's where you got interested in talking about it on your podcast.
Yeah, it is so unusual to find somebody who was in such a bustling place and is now in a pretty remote area. I know you said there are about 2,000 people where you are and 6,000 closer by, but to come from Washington, which is huge, to there, what happened? How did that happen?
Well, let's see. As I said, I was going to school in Portland. I wanted to become a veterinarian, and I quickly realized that I did not want to spend all of my time inside, as you know, as vets do, spending time in the vet office and all of that. So I started going to the local parks in Portland and started offering dog training to the rich stay-at-home moms, if you will. You know, everybody has issues. So I pretty much showed up with a dog leash, a business card, and a smile, and started my own little dog training business right there in the parks of the affluent neighborhoods of Portland, Oregon. And I realized, man, this is a little bit better way to earn a living than sitting in a vet office, even though it would have been cool to become a veterinarian. But hey, that's how it works. So I flew out to a dog training company. This is in the early 90s, well before dog training schools were a thing. And I went to a dog school in Columbus, Ohio, and became a certified dog trainer in 1991. And that's when the trajectory started. I realized that I could do this as a business, and I became a professional dog trainer then. It took me about 6 years to finally earn that bachelor's degree. The first time, you know, as a college kid, you have other priorities than being in class all the time. So I did that, and eventually my grandfather passed away. He passed away in 1994, and he had a little cabin up in the northern area of Minnesota. And we knew about it as a family, but we didn't really ever attend there. You know, it's just sort of a out of the way, like hunting cabin type thing. And he left me that cabin in his will. So I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. Let's see what we can do. So I spent time in Minnesota and in Oregon, going back and forth in the off seasons. And lo and behold, I started getting involved in dog sledding, in dog mushing, because we were in a rural area. And of course, you know, things just sort of worked out that way. So I started accumulating a pack of sled dogs when I was moving into my grandparents' home in Minnesota. And that's how I started in dog mushing, which is, we can talk about what that is in a second if you'd like. But went from the other big city on the other side of the country to a very rural area of northern Minnesota and started dog mushing. I met my wife in 1999, and we eventually moved to Alaska in 2010 to chase the crazy Iditarod dream. And I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, what is Iditarod? We can talk about that in a second if you want. So we moved to Alaska in 2010, and here we are 14 years later with a beautiful home here in the woods of Alaska and doing our thing.
Wow, that is some journey.
Yes.
From a park training pampered mums, pooches.
Yes.
To pretty wild South Alaska with some pretty tough dogs. That's quite a difference. Did you always have an affinity for dogs then, rather than any other animals? Or was it just the outdoors?
Yes, we had dogs growing up. We always had working dogs. I grew up with Springer Spaniels, which was more of a hunting type dog. But my first dog ever, I was 17 years old. It was a Siberian Husky, of course, a sled dog type dog. And I got him pretty much right after high school. That was my first dog purchase, if you will. And I took him to competition obedience and dog sports and all that sort of stuff. So he was my first real sled dog. And I had him until he passed away many years later. And now here we have 35 dogs, I believe we have, and just a couple of Siberian Huskies. So I still have an affinity for the breed.
It's amazing that something, you know, starts that young and now you've made not just a career, but a whole life out of it.
Yes.
You mentioned mulching. Can you start off by explaining a bit about that? Because for here, us here in England, you know, I don't have a clue what that is.
Okay. So dog mushing is a sled. So think about like a toboggan sled that you would see out in the snowy areas. And we have a team of dogs attached to it. And we can have two dogs, four dogs, 12 dogs, 16 dogs, whatever. I typically run a 10 or a 12 dog team. So we have dogs lined up in pairs, hooked up to a wooden or metal or whatever type sled that we have. And they're pulling us through the trails in the wilderness. And there's a sport of it called the Iditarod here in Alaska. It's a 1,000-mile race that goes from Anchorage to Nome. One of these days, I will do that race. We do it all winter long. We get about 12 to 14 feet of snow here every year. So thankfully the snow just melted. Here we are at the first week of May, I guess it is. And, we can finally see, grass coming up, but yes, our entire life is revolving around taking care of our sled dogs. And that's what we do. I teach college courses on the sport, and it is truly a lifestyle.
That's it. And do you have people come and train with you there as well, or just at the college?
Mainly just at the college. It's really a family business. My wife, my daughter, and I run the entire business right here, along with our dog training company, Alaska Dog Works. And we teach two college courses a year. It takes pretty much the entire winter, but we are the only dog mushing course in the United States, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And do you get people from all over the states come from? To you from Michigan and everywhere where you've been before?
Most of them are in particular programs at the college, like the one here at Alaska Pacific University. It's a private college here in Anchorage, Alaska. They have an outdoor leadership program. So this is a course that they have in their curriculum. And at our course at the University of Alaska Anchorage, it's open to other students. And sometimes folks that are not enrolled in college, so non-degree seeking students can sign up for that and take that course as well. It's not nearly as intense as the first one that we teach, but we've taught a lot of people over the years.
And it's a sport, it's an endurance sport, particularly if you're going to go and do this 1,000-mile trek. You must have to have some strength and fitness.
Well, it is an endurance sport. More than anything, it's just a heck of a long time out in very cold weather. It's not as strenuous as you may think, other than just being out in the elements. I mean, you know, obviously the dogs are doing a lot of the work because they're the ones that are pulling the sled. But it takes a little bit of grit to be able to do that for many days on end.
I mean, how cold does it get there?
Frequently, we are well below zero. We typically have about a month or so in January where it's about negative 35 Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but pretty dang chilly.
Yeah, definitely. And how warm does it get? You know, you say you're mostly above negative. In the warmest months, what is it, 4 or 5 degrees?
Let's see, we are about 75-ish degrees Fahrenheit in the summertime. So a very nice summer. Doesn't get too hot. To us, 70 degrees is a warm summer for sure.
You've been out there 14 years. I wasn't going to ask you this, but have you been affected by the climate change at all in the time you've been there?
Very much. We can see it. We can see it every year. It's raining more here than it has been in the last 10 years or so. So we're getting a lot more rain, a little bit less snow. I know I said that we get 10 or 12 feet of snow, but the snow is arriving later than it did before. A lot of erosion with the rivers. It is a little bit warmer. And again, 70 degrees is not warm, but even a degree or so really makes it. So yes, the climate change is real here in the north.
I think you notice it more at the extremes. You know, where we are here in, it's pretty temperate in, you know, the south coast of England, you don't notice it, but I can imagine it's much more noticeable where you're used to those extremes. How has that affected your lifestyle then?
Well, as I said, the snow is arriving later. Typically, we like to be on dog sleds on Thanksgiving. We have a tradition where we put the turkey in the oven on Thanksgiving and go outside and jump on the dog sleds and go for a run. And it's been more and more difficult to be able to do that. We're going into later in November, early December now. So snow is arriving a little bit later and it's leaving us sooner. Typically, we will have snow on the ground, even a snowstorm or more in mid-April. And I think we got our last snow this year at the end of March. So even just those couple of weeks of changing seasons, when you're training for racing or longer expeditions, when you have later time to get into that training mode, if you will, it slows down your progress to be able to do whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, I can well imagine that. And you say you do this with your wife.
Yes.
And your daughter. I mean, how did they feel when you said, well, your daughter, I don't know if she was around then or not. How did they feel when you said, oh, no, we're going to go and pursue this. We're going to move from Michigan up to Alaska. How were the family?
This is probably the coolest story that I have. So we were living in Denver, Colorado, and we had a company there called Denver Dog Works, where we're doing dog training in the suburbs of Denver. So you can imagine the big city and, you know, training pet dogs and the whole nine yards. And I got this itch to think, I really would like to go visit Alaska and, you know, try to go after that dream that I had. So my daughter was 12 years old, and I said, hey, her name is Nicole. I said, hey, Nicole, would you like to go on a trip with Dad up to Alaska? And of course, any young lady would say, yes, I would love to. So we jumped on a plane, her first plane trip ever, and we flew up to Alaska in July of 2010. And we arrived at this place, the place that we're standing, where I'm sitting in right now, and it was just a mess. It was a rental home.
Right.
It was just trashed, right? So we walked into the house and, you know, the realtor showed us around a little bit and we looked around and, you know, I thought, can this work? And this is what I did. I said, okay, Nicole, I'm going to leave it in your hands. I'm going to say, this is your decision. And she had a little flip phone. She was 12 years old. This is, you know, well before iPhones and all of that. And I said, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to text your mom. Her mom was back in Denver. It was a Saturday afternoon and she was teaching group classes to a group of dog training clients. And I said, I want you to text your mom and I want you to let her know what your decision is. And I had no idea what her decision was going to be. And she texted her mom and she said, Mom, we are moving to Alaska. And I remember like it was yesterday. Later on, my wife, Michelle, called me up and said, Robert, what in the world are you doing? And I said, well, she made the decision. So we are moving north. And we bought the place and it took a long time to get it where it is today. And we moved up the family and it took about a year to get everybody up here because we didn't want to yank the kids out of school and all of that. So, you know, the kids came up and then Michelle came up after they closed the business and all of that. And her parents really helped out a lot by allowing them to live there and, you know, how that goes. So we finally moved up here in 2010 and jumped into the dog mushing lifestyle. My daughter eventually did the junior Iditarod twice as a teenager. The junior Iditarod is about 170 miles, I believe, in the wilderness. So imagine a 14-year-old out there in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of winter, and she did that. So it's a real feather in her cap, if you will. And she's still working with us today. Now she is a 25, 26 year old woman and a partner in our family business and doing very well.
Wow. As a 14-year-old. So what, I mean, you must have worried this 14-year-old's there in the wilderness. I know they've got support, but how did you feel when she was out there doing that?
Well, she had a little bit of an independent streak, as you can imagine, when she's buy homes at 12 years old. But she did very well. She did a lot of training. She was very well prepared. We did a lot of work together, you know, with our dog teams and winter camping and all of that. She was very prepared. And it's one of those things that that you sort of learn how to do, I guess, if you will, and it just becomes second nature to you, sort of like learning how to ride a bike and then going out on a long bike ride. But I felt comfortable. She felt very comfortable. I think mom was a little bit more worried than I was. She did it once. She did it a second time. And now she is a veteran at it. So she really enjoyed it.
Wow. And you say that, you know, she did it and she loved it. You've done lots of races. Have you ever been in any tricky situations where you've been on a race or at all when you've been out in the wilderness?
I've had a lot of experiences. Races are a heck of a lot more controlled than like an expedition or something like that, because obviously there's support and, you know, everybody's out there making sure the race goes. I remember several times where I was in really tricky situations. We did a expedition across Alaska in 2020, and we were out on the Yukon River. The Yukon River is about a mile and a half wide or so, so it's a very large river in the middle of Alaska, and we had to traverse that for almost 4 days. It took 4 days on the river, so we had to camp two nights on the river in these large, they call them Arctic oven tents, so very large tents with stoves in them to keep warm, and it was minus 57 degrees Fahrenheit. It was very, very cold, and we were going through overflow, and overflow is where water melts on the ice and is on top of the ice of the river. So you have snow, water, ice, and we were going through overflow up to our chest, so a very, very deep overflow, because you can't see it as it comes upon you. You know, it looks just like a snowy section of the river. So as we got there, we were having to navigate around with our snow machines and our dog teams. And we were really struggling going through that overflow at those temperatures. And the dogs did fine. They had no issues because obviously they know how to go around it, because they can, I guess they can sense it compared to us. So our heavy sleds and our heavy gear ended up just bogging down in it, and we were just absolutely soaked. But we were literally in the middle of nowhere, with nowhere to go except for our tents, you know, because there's no lodges or anything. You had to go from one spot to another. So it was a harrowing situation for all of us, but we persevered and made it through. But that was an experience I'll never forget.
Very, very frightening. How many of you were there in that group?
I believe there were 13 of us. So about 7 dog teams, 6 snow machines, snowmobile supports. So we had all of our gear on the snow machines, and then the dog teams would travel with the dogs. And so the snow machines were in front of us, and then the dog teams were behind. So it was like an expedition.
And that sounds extremely scary to me. But you obviously all got through it. I mean, have you been in any situations where you thought, actually, I don't think I'm going to get through this. I'm going to have to turn back. I'm going to stop. Have you ever had that?
Well, that was by far the biggest kind of crucible of our trip, was to be able to figure out, are we going to continue? Because we were really, really struggling in the middle of nowhere. But most of the times it's relatively uneventful. You know, I've done so many miles on a dog sled that I can go through most any situation and not have an issue. I mean, we've had wildlife encounters and, you know, just about everything. But Mother Nature, she's her own beast. She makes the rules out there, and you have to be able to really learn how to deal with whatever she throws at you. And I think that that she will win over all of us for sure.
Definitely. You've said you've had a few hair-raising moments there. Have there been any particular highs when you've done it? You know, you thought, this is it. This is why I've done this.
Oh, yeah. There are so many of those. And one story I like to tell is, I was out on a 150-mile race, and I was in pretty much last place. I've never been a speed demon out there on the trail, so I just go out there and enjoy the time on the trail. But I was on a race called the Goose Bay 150, and it was very late at night. I was coming into the checkpoint, so the halfway point of the race, and everybody else was up at the lodge at the checkpoint doing their thing, getting rest and all of that. It was about midnight or so. And what you have to do when you pull in camp is you have to do all of your dog chores. So you have to set up camp and make the food and all of that. And I was doing that, and I figured, okay, it's a good time to get a little bit of a rest. So what I typically do is I will stay outside with my dogs. So we bed them down on straw so they get nice and cozy. And then I will either lay down on the straw or kind of lean up against my dog sled. And I threw my really heavy parka over my head, and I got a little bit of rest. And I don't know how long it was, a couple of hours or so, the dog started howling. So I thought, okay, somebody's getting ready to leave. So I took my parka off of my head, and I looked around, and I saw the most beautiful northern lights I'd ever seen in my life. It was an absolute beautiful aurora borealis above me. It was snowing a little bit, and it was one of the most breathtaking scenes I'd ever seen. And then I looked around a little bit more, and I was the only one outside. Everybody else was still up in the checkpoint doing their thing. So there I was with my dog team, sort of alone in the middle of a race, witnessing this spectacular show above me. You know, it was about minus 20 or so Fahrenheit. It was an absolutely beautiful night, and one of the highlights of my racing career.
Wow. That's the sort of thing you live for, isn't it? Moments like that that you aren't expecting. And then there's, as you said, Mother Nature just presents these beautiful things.
100%.
Quite something. And you've done an awful lot. What is probably the thing you're most proud of that you've done?
Probably our business. As I mentioned, we have a pretty successful family business, and we always have thrived to make sure that it stays in the company or in the family. And I think that is our most important asset, if you will. It's going to be something that we pass along to our daughter. We are working towards a succession plan with that. So it's that legacy that you have to be able to pass along. And it's a lot of work. Anytime you have a very small family business, there's a lot of work there. But I am very proud that we've been able to support ourselves and have a family business that's been able to provide everything that we have. And to be able to pass that along to our kids is very important to us.
You followed your heart, you know, it wouldn't have been the same. Do you ever think to yourself, gosh, you know, if I'd just been that vet in that city,
things would be a lot different. I probably still would have been working with dogs and small animals for sure. But obviously, I would never have met my wife. We probably never would have moved to Alaska. Obviously, you know, things sort of just worked out that way. But I think I would have been doing a lot of the same things that I'm doing now. But, you know, life has a way of shifting gears a little bit, if you will.
And it's lovely. Family is really, really important to you. I can tell because you want to keep this business in the family. And from the way you're talking, your dogs are very much part of your family as well.
100%.
Yeah, it does sound like that. What advice would you give somebody else that wants to make a move like you have, set up their own business, move to the wilds, or any dream that they may be following their heart?
Follow it. Whatever it is, go after it. I think that's the most important thing. So many people contemplate things and never do what they want to do. You know, they overanalyze or overthink. Just follow that path, whatever that path is. And there's going to be stumbles along the way. There's going to be trials and tribulations. But often, if you really follow, and it's not always a dream, it could be just a career path or a school path or a project that you want to do that you're contemplating, just follow the path, whatever that leads you. And I think that you're going to have a real payoff in the end.
Very, very good advice. I would agree with that. That's what I always tell people. And it's not the norm to do what you've done, but it's clearly done you well. You said a little bit there about what your ambition is with this big race. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and why you want to do it? Why?
Yes.
Why 1,000 miles?
So as I mentioned, I chased the crazy Iditarod dream. So the Iditarod is a 1,000-mile race from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska. So literally across the state of Alaska through the wilderness. And it's been a race that's been going on since the early 70s. And it harkens back to the Serum Run days. So think about Balto and Togo. So a lot of people know that story. And it sort of pays homage to that. And it's truly the pinnacle of our sport. It's sort of like the Super Bowl or the Indianapolis 500 or whatever in our sport. And it's sort of that crowning achievement. And I've always thought this is something I want to do. And truly the reason why we moved to Alaska, just to be able to have that opportunity. But when I moved up here, I quickly realized that, number one, it takes a lot of time. Number two, it is very expensive. It's about a $70,000 commitment to be able to do that. So very
expensive
to do that. But the oldest person that ever started that race was 74 years old. I'm 53 right now. So I still have 20 years before I'm the oldest. So I'm not too old yet. But one of these days, I will enter that race and finish it. And that's sort of that, like I said about my daughter, the feather in the cap deal. One of these days, I will do that.
What an ambition to have.
Yes.
And does she want to do something like that, or is she rooting for you to do it?
Well, sort of here and there. She is very supportive of what we do, obviously. But she's had her time, if she will. When she was in high school, obviously, that's when she did the junior race. And then she left. She had to go spread her wings a little bit. And she moved out and, you know, went to school for a little while and did her thing. And then she came back to us and started working with us several years later. And I remember her saying, I don't know if I ever want to do a race again. I did my thing. That's you, Dad. You do your thing, and I will support you in any endeavor. But I think my racing career is over, and I'm fine with that. You know, she did her thing. She accomplished her goals, and now she's our little support system, if you will.
You say there about a support system. When you were setting out, you mentioned that your wife's parents were really, really supportive. Have any of the other wider family moved up to Alaska with you?
Nope, it's just us. Our oldest son still lives in Denver. He is doing very well on his own down there. Our two other kids are here. We have a son. His name is Tyler. He lives, I don't know, about 20 miles or so down the road. He has a young boy, a young child on his own. So he's doing his thing. And so it's just really the four of us, and everybody else is scattered throughout the country.
Wow, what a way to be.
Yes.
It gives you plenty of places to go to. Well, it's been fascinating listening to all of this. Is there anything that you feel I should have asked you that I haven't asked you?
I think we covered a lot. I really wanted to share my story. I know that that podcasting is a very interesting way to hear about other people's lifestyles. And I think that that's the important thing that we get across. I've been podcasting for a very long time, since 2009. And I don't think we've ever missed a week. So it's been a long haul, but I really love the medium. I'm honored to be on as a guest, and it's always fun to talk to people in an area of the world that is totally different than where you're at. And I think that that's a very cool thing.
Definitely. Well, I mean, I would love to come to Alaska at some point. And if you come to, you know, the south coast of England, I will happily show you around here.
I would love it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much for being on our guest, and good luck. Maybe when you've done that race, I need to get you back again.
Let's do it.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Well, huge thanks to Robert, and of course to you, our listeners. I can't begin to imagine how harrowing it was to go through that overflow in minus 47 degrees. Till next time, take care.